Welcome to the PI Podcast, political insights for the palaging inis. I'm your host, Matt Ordonez. And for you listeners out there, you know that this is a podcast of readers. You know, I'm a big reader and a big book guy. I'm a kind of person who owns more books than clothes, actually, even if you count all the socks as two, you know, count all the gloves, all the jackets, I'd still have more books. And I'm sure you guys are into books too. Well, this episode is going to be all about books, and not just, of course, what we read, you know, and book recommendations. We always have that for you here, but basically what books mean to the Philippine society at large and how it is, you know, an object of politics. We are very much excited for our guest today. He knows a lot about books. You know, there's not enough hours of the day to lay out all he knows. But before we get to our very special guest, this podcast, aligning with the book theme, is produced in partnership with the Manila International Book Fair 2023. So the Manila International Book Fair is the largest and longest running book fair in the Philippines and has been running for 43 years and counting. And it is back for another year of a lot of events, of book launches, of book forums, and book sales. The fair will feature over 100 exhibitors from mainstream and indie publishers to international publishers, university presses, academic publishers, distributors, and bookstores selling the latest titles. The event will also include book signings with National Artists for Literature, celebrity authors, Wattpad sensations, comic book creators, and international best-selling writers. This will, of course, be held at the SMX Convention Center on September 14 to 17 from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. So hope to see you all there. Maybe I'll see you there myself. I usually go there as an annual, habit and haul lots of books. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's move on to our guest. He is a good friend of mine who I met. Of course, he was working at the Ateneo University Press, done a lot of good work there. And he is now currently the OIC Division Chief of the Policy and Industry Research Division of the National Book Development Board. So yeah, not only has he worked in publishing, but also he's helped contribute in forming policies for our book-related policies for a government. So please welcome Kevin D. Hello, Kevin. Welcome to the PI Podcast.
Hi, Matt. Hello, listeners.
Okay. So before we get into the topics, why don't you tell everyone, you know, the listeners, you know, how you got into publishing and, you know, getting into books? Like, why books? Why this career in books? Yeah.
Ooh, that's a doozy. I've always been reading. I was always one of those weird kids just reading like Bullfinch's Greek Mythology, Aesop's Fables as a kid. My uncle, as you might know, also teaches philosophy in Ateneo, Manny D. So
yep.
I've always, his gifts were always something like philosophy. So I was growing up as reading like little, not like his entire philosophical treatises, but like little tidbits about the life of Aristotle, of Socrates, the Chinese philosophers, because that's my uncle's specialty. So I was always around books, and I really fell in love with fiction in particular. I had a whole phase where I was just reading all these big doorstop novels, like War and Peace, all that stuff. I was reading a lot. I was actually, interestingly enough, I was in pre-med in college, and then I just remember, I was like, I don't know what I want to do with my life. I just asked my roommate, who eventually became like our valedictorian of the batch. And he was like, he's always known that he wanted to be a doctor. I was like, I don't. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure my way out. And then I shifted to philosophy. And then I just kept reading and reading. And then I guess like this is like a very tumultuous period in my life. I got depressed. And I realized that, you know, I was trying to find answers in books, and I realized that this sort of way of trying to map out, you know, like possible like trajectories for your life, like that's something that reading, like dialoguing with like the greatest minds of who are long dead, that's only something that publishing and reading can do. This sort of like mass produced like sort of intimate discourse,
Mm-hmm.
if you will. That's what I've always found was the unique, something uniquely appealing about this particular format, this particular medium. Whether you're reading fiction, whether you're reading philosophy, you're reading essays, all that sort of thing. There's always this intimate dialogue with another consciousness that's just hard to replicate with other mediums, if not impossible. So that's how like I sort of fell in love with it. Now, how did I get into publishing in particular? Right after college, I knew I wanted to be around books. I didn't know exactly how I would do that. Spent a year helping out my family. And then I thought I'd wanted to be in academe. I tried to take a master's in literature. And then it just didn't feel right. But I had a professor who was, interesting enough, he had like a very strange discipline, strange approach. She was a book historian.
Mm-hmm.
So she studied the book as a thing. This is Patricia May Hurilia.
Yes.
UP. Yeah. So, I mean, I was reading about like literary theory, and of course, like literary theory is really just philosophy. Like you just kind of shoehorn it with a literary text, you know. So, I was kind of tired of that after like 4 years of philosophy, and then I was getting tired of that, and then suddenly, like I take her class, and then we're talking about the binding, the paper, this whole like the life cycle of a book, you know,
right?
Like, the decision to publish, the material conditions that allow, you know, books, a reading culture, like this intimate connection with another mind, the material conditions to make it possible. Just
right.
I start like, yeah. So it was really like open a new chapter, I guess, in this whole love of books. So I started to really fall in love with that aspect. So I was thinking about like, how do I make, I guess, like if there's any like any unifying, animating theme or question, like for this career that I've chosen, it's like, how do I enable this sort of contact between one consciousness and another, that only books can, I believe, provide, you know. So how do I foster that? So
yeah.
After that, I worked with an ebook company for a while. We would work with like local publishers. It was actually the sister company of this more company that would do ebooks for like the then Big Five publishers. So Big Five publishers are like Penguin, Random House. They had, I believe, they were just about to complete their merger then. Simon and Schuster, Macmillan, I'm forgetting another. In any case, so from there, I realized I was doing research, similar to what I'm kind of doing now, trying to map out like stakeholders in the publishing industry, trying to help with like, you know, strategy. And then I realized a lot of our publishers weren't really taking advantage of social media very well. So I left that. I intentionally joined a digital marketing company for about a year just to learn the chops. And then I got involved with this book project that eventually I brought to Ateneo Press when I applied. And that book became the bestseller. And then that's sort of how I got my job. That was like my interview. You know, I brought that book to the press. I facilitated that and then helped organize. I was like a one-man team, still not with the press then. But what my boss to be at Ateneo Press at that time was Karina Bolasco. She said it was the single most successful book launch she attended because we sold like almost 20% of the print run in the first hour of the
wow.
launch. So
amazing.
From there, now I'm talking like now we're fast forward. I joined Oxford University Press for a brief stint. It wasn't very good fit, I guess. It was just the idea of promoting, you know, trying to help foreign publisher trying to break into the Philippine market. I kind of wanted to help local publishing flourish more. So I left that after a while, and then I joined the National Book Development Board. So that's like the very short version of my sort of career. That's a long way of answering like how I got here. But here I am.
Well, it's definitely well accomplished, you know. And so before we get more into like the local publishing, of course, I always wanted you to be on the podcast. But before, well, I mean, while conceptualizing this podcast, I think you insisted that we look into the Frankfurt Book Fair And this is a big deal, you know, I mentioned this, and I read it as you advised by you. And yes, the Philippines apparently is the guest of honor in the Frankfurt Book Fair for 2025. That's a yes, it's a few years from now. And the more I read it, apparently it's only one of two Southeast Asian countries to be the guest of honor.
Yes.
And one
second,
of the after Indonesia, and then we join maybe a few other Asian countries to have ever been the guest of honor. Usually, if you look at the list, it's like France, Germany, even Iceland, actually at one point.
Yes.
But the Philippines apparently will be the guest of honor soon. So perhaps you can explain more to the listeners, like why this is a big deal and what this means for Philippine publishing and Philippine readers.
So in the book world, first of all, let's get one thing out of the way. So you mentioned like MIBF is co-producing this podcast. The Frankfurt Book Fair is very different from the sort of book fairs that we have here. So MIBF is what we would call a retail fair. So when you say a retail fair, you know, people show up, people buy copies, they go home. Usually stuff is on sale. There's a few events here and there. But with the Frankfurt Book Fair, it's really more about, it's less a consumer-facing one. It's more of business-to-business. It's more of a business event. So this is where a lot of the major deals are closed. So you can talk anything from translation and licensing deals to merchandise, movie deals, distribution contracts. So it's a lot of where the big deals are made. So no one actually goes to Frankfurt to, well, as with their primary reason to sell, like, physical copies of books. They're there to sell rights usually, or make business or acquire rights, right? Or maybe they want to find new partnerships to help promote their book. Maybe they want to say, let's just say, I have the Philippine rights. I want to work with a publisher who's going to do the U.S. edition or the German edition or German translation, and so on and so forth. So that's where all the big deals are made. Now, the big Frankfurt Book Fair is just humongous. So just trying to give a frame of reference. All right. So it was my first time to attend, actually, last year. Relatively speaking, it was the first real Frankfurt Book Fair since... it was, I think, the second real Frankfurt Book Fair since the pandemic. Right? So still kind of lower key compared to how it usually is, because you know, things were just coming out of lock. A lot of countries were only coming out of lockdown. A lot of people were still cautious.
Yeah.
But even then, it was just massive. One hall is about twice the size of the SMX Convention Center in Moab.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so one hall is like twice of that. And the Messe, with the convention grounds in Frankfurt, has about 12 halls.
So that's like 24 of SMX conventions.
I believe last year, to be fair, Frankfurt only occupied 6 or 7 halls. But if I'm not mistaken, usually they occupy all prior to the pandemic. So obviously a lot of countries were still hesitant. But in any case, it was just daunting, right? So what does it mean to be guest of honor at such a huge event like that?
Right.
It means a lot of the... It basically means you're the belle of the ball. You're the main focus of a lot of the major programming. A lot of the attention is going to you. And usually it means a lot of business deals are going your way. A lot of publishers will want to meet with you. So the spotlight really is on your country, your cultural production, the books that you publish, and so on. So your literature, your literary culture, your reading culture, that's really the spotlight for the Frankfurt Book Fair.
Right.
It's insane how much that actually impacts, like, the deals that you're able to make. So usually, like, a lot of the countries that are guests of honor, there's even several years after that, they still reap the benefits because of, you know, the facilities, a lot of meetings and the connections you make. It's a big deal. This year, I believe it's Slovenia. That's the guest of honor, and their slogan is "Honeycomb of Words," which I thought was pretty clever.
Yeah.
We don't have our slogan yet. I believe our team is working on that. So yeah, Indonesia's was 17,000 Islands of Imagination. If I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah,
It's
so
cold.
I was obviously we can't cause we they obviously have more islands than us. We have to go a different approach probably.
Okay.
We'll see. But
Hopefully.
in any case, so Frankfurt Book Fair is absolutely huge, and it's a huge honor. Senator Lauren Legarda has been working on this since 2015 with the National Book Develop Mart to sort of campaign to be the guest of honor, targeting the year 2025, and finally it's come into fruition. So when Indonesia, I believe she got inspiration when Indonesia won. So it's exactly 10 years since Indonesia won a guest of honor, and it's opened our eyes to what's possible that hey, we can have this too. 10 years hence now, the Philippines will be guest of honor 2025.
That's amazing. That's something to look forward to. Although before I move to the next topic, I'm actually curious to know, do you think the Philippines is ready to be a part of such an event? Like, what do we have to offer? Is it to the world of publishing? Big question, I know,
Well,
but yeah.
so I'm looking at it from obviously when you get such a prestigious award, what we're looking at, I mean, me and my colleagues at the National Book Development Board, is
Yes.
just the enormity of work that's ahead of us. So right now, if you ask, like, of course we'll be ready. Of course we're
You will
preparing.
be. Okay. Good
Yeah,
answer.
so it's not so much like, oh, what can are we ready? It's more of what do we need to do to prepare, right? We have about 2 years to prepare,
Right.
right? So that means we need to help out our publishers. Just how are they able to close these deals? Even now, you need to help them build relationships. Sometimes it's just a matter of like helping them, like capacity building. What sort of deals are good deals that they can make? Maybe they can look into countries that they weren't making deals with publishers in countries that they weren't looking at before, so we could provide them that sort of market research support. But really, like, it's understanding who we are as a country in terms of our literary, our culture, our publishing output, and what other countries want, right? So one interesting thing is like apparently Germany, for example, has a huge interest in like thrillers, crime fiction, that sort of thing. So what do we have to offer that matches that, right? It's really less about like it's too daunting, honestly, if you think like what does the world want? And then usually what I find when you start thinking of like trying to do and you try to you end up with a sort of a least common denominator that doesn't really kind of work. Each country will have its own particular taste. Some will be interested in our romance titles. So, for example, like one of our big cultural exports is our telenovelas, for example. So there are people in other countries who would be like who would actually know. Oh, that's so and so celebrity, Manatee Idol, right? Matinee Idol. Sorry.
I know Catherine Bernardo and Daniel Padilla are known in
Yes.
Indonesia and some parts
Yes.
of
There
South
you
Africa
go.
and India. So yeah,
Yeah, there
we
you go.
export.
So there's really a lot that we can offer. There's also a lot that we need to do in order to prepare to be able to sh to show the best version of ourselves,
Yeah,
if I may.
I look forward to that. I'm sure you have a lot of research to do, but maybe I don't know,
Oh
maybe
my God.
you're top of your head. I'm so sorry. I'm just curious though.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think is our best shot or like our juiciest product offering that we can offer right now
Oh,
to the
I don't
world?
know. There's nothing. Okay, I wouldn't say the best because like it's kind of like, picking your children. You can't say, And of course, we want to help out everyone. I will say that there's so we all I also went to like the London Book Fair last year. So the two major book fairs usually, especially in the Western world, are the London the English speaking world or London and the Frankfurt Book Fairs. So the London Book Fair, we brought our comics. So we brought along Paulo Heras of Comiket. And we brought a lot of our Filipino comics. And honestly, our artists are world class, to be honest. Our comic artists are world class. Pesce has already gotten a lot of interest. Been published in Dasher by Tuttle. If I'm not mistaken. Well, no, sorry, not Tuttle. Was it Tuttle who did? No, it was Ablaze, I think, that did the international edition. And a lot of the other titles from Avenida and Visprint/Visprint were licensed, or like the rights were acquired by Tuttle. So comics, for one, our fiction has also been tense, because when you say fiction, that's a huge variety.
Yeah.
And you can't, it's kind of hard to say. And yeah. This is where I go to, like what I said, go back to what I said earlier. Mm-hmm. That it really depends on what the country's interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have, it's really, that's why the focus really of the fair is business matching. Because you have to match, all right, what do we have to offer versus what a particular country, a particular market would be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction,
comics,
a lot of romance titles. Yeah, I think are an offer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised, like, and we can get to that later about how our huge romance output.
You mean our Wattpad novels?
I mean, not necessarily the Wattpad novels. Maybe they could be, but there, you'd be surprised by like what people are what not only our own puppies, but what other countries, other markets might be looking at. Gina Apostol's, although this is, she published, this is, I mentioned because she's one of my favorite authors. So just to show, like people, like, tend to think, or Filipinos tend to think that, you know, we're unsure, might be insecure about our literary output. But we have, like, novelists who are already publishing, like, internationally.
Yeah.
Gina Apostol novels, The Revolution According to Raymundo Mata, Bibliolepsy, Gun Dealer's Daughter. These were all published in the Philippines first by Anvil and UP Press. And before they had international editions and, you know, international recognition, right? So, smaller and smaller circles by F.H. Batakan. There was a smaller, like a slimmer UP Press edition.
Yeah.
And then they came up with an expanded and revised edition for, I believe it was, I don't want to speak out of turn. I'm not sure if it was Soho who published it, Soho Press.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, we do have world-class authors and world-class talent, right? So it's really just a matter of helping our publishers find these deals so that we can be more, I guess, accessible to the world.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's very important to, especially here in the podcast, although, it's already there, our authors are getting international recognition. And I think this is momentum from that. But I think one thing we have to establish also, besides, of course, our literary talent, is, of course, our markets. And let's move on to, basically, I want to ask you about our reading market here in the Philippines. And despite, of course, the mismatch and the usual stereotypes of Filipinos having usually less than desirable literacy rates and levels of education. Yeah. I wanted to ask, like, how many Filipinos read and how much do we read? Because apparently, if there are some authors like this, you know, of course, they should have readers, you know. So can you tell us, based on your knowledge, how Filipinos are in terms of reading?
Okay, so there's a lot to... Again, there's a lot to tackle about this question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously our literacy scores have plummeted in recent years. Part of this whole learning poverty statistic, and also learning loss during the pandemic.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it really has to do with obviously, like, literacy and just inculcating the love of reading. Department of Education, who we work with for a lot of things concerning textbooks and other books for the libraries. The policy surrounding that, curing of those materials, they're very cognizant of problem, and that's why they're coming up with they've come up with their national reading program, the national learners, national learning camp, also basically looking at ways for remediation in terms of our interest, like, as a society in reading. I will say this, it's a lot higher than people think, right? So what I've come to realize when I encounter, you know, the usual middle-class Filipino would say, Filipinos don't read, is that it's sort of self-condescension, I guess, or maybe like condescension towards a certain, maybe there's also a class thing there, that say, Filipinos, so iniisip mo yung masa, di naman nagbabasa. But which is actually untrue. It's just that you'd find they're not reading the things that you would consider like stuff that you would read, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So our romance category is huge. Absolutely huge. One of our biggest publishers is trade publishers is Precious Hearts Romance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they sell a lot of romance titles.
Mm-hmm.
They sell a lot of romance titles. They distribute almost everywhere, and they have their own stores, right? And June Matias really grew this business, and several of these authors bought houses off those books, right? So our romance, the romance category is just huge, right? Comics again, we mentioned earlier, we had a long tradition of comics, of serialized comics, although that sort of folded, I believe, during when the Ross's family, or the Ross SS, sort of closed shop.
I see.
But we're seeing a big renaissance again, I guess, of comics.
So from Mars Ravelo to these new indie,
So with your Tresses, your Manix Abreras, your who else? Well, we could put in maybe Nino J. Ignacio, your Dead Palagtas, Tarantado Calvo. Right?
He was a guest on the show, so yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Check out that episode. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, his name is also Kevin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice guy. Yeah. So, really, I guess it's here's how I think about it. Let's put things in the context. Right. Our trade publishing is very young, right? Prior to the 1990s, there was very little, if any, outside of romance, right? So I've already discussed, but there's very little outside of romance and textbooks. Okay. So, and I'll get into like there's different publishing like sectors, and I'll get into that later.
Sure.
So prior to the 90s, it was only a really I believe the pioneer there was my former boss, Karina Bolasco, who we rightfully during the National Book Awards gave a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Mm-hmm.
Like she really like came out with all these. She worked with National Bookstore and under National Bookstore, she's set up and founded and basically ran Anvil for the better part of, I want to say, like almost 3 decades. So they came out with a lot of fiction, a lot of nonfiction, books, essay collection, short story collections, and really like it just went from there. A huge part of really creating a quote unquote helping Filipinos read, if you think that's a problem, is really making the books that they would want to read. A lot of Filipinos like read humor, so a lot of that's why. And a lot of based on the readership surveys we've done in the past, a lot of it also is understandably ways for upward mobility. So a lot of it is self help, personal finance.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously the first thing they'll say is the Bible because we're also very religious, a very majority Christian, very religious country. So. Ooh, definitely. There is definitely a reading culture. Just around our religious practices, there's already a huge reading culture, right? So, but I say that because I think it's really more about creating a readership around your books. And this is where the publishers, the vision of a particular publisher is very important, right? So, one of the pioneering collections that Macarena came out with, this, for example, was Ladlad. So, this anthology of gay literature, edited by Janiel Garcia and Danton Remoto, and it was really like first, I believe, if not the first, it was definitely a pioneering for trade publishing at that time. I hesitate. I always worry if I'm saying the first if it's correct because I might be speaking incorrectly, you know. But it was definitely a such an important landmark work for. LGBT rights, LGBT literature. It wasn't even LGBT at the time. It was it was Philippine gay. It was Philippine gay, so male homosexuals mostly. But then also they'd come out with a collection on lesbian writing. So these are just very, like, really groundbreaking titles. So history, obviously one of the more popular titles Anvil came out with, Jessica Zafra's short story collections of columns, and for fiction and nonfiction, if I'm not mistaken, Ambito Campo, obviously. Yeah, so his columns, and then bringing it to them, why don't you compile these into a book, right? So making history popular, accessible.
Yes.
So, like, and I've worked with Ateneo Press for a while, and our history titles were always one of our bestsellers, and our political science titles.
Yeah.
But, like, Filipinos are very, very, very interested in their own history. So how usually you do that by reading a lot. So so really, like, let's do away with this notion that Filipinos don't read. The question is, like, are we producing titles? Are we really creating, fostering this readership by providing them the titles that they'd actually be interested in? Because I really believe everyone's like a person who doesn't read is just a person who hasn't found a book that really speaks to them yet. Right. So I will also shout out, sorry, I know this is a bit long way to answer your question. I'll shout out another publisher who I believe is basically trailblazing into a totally charted or newer territory, and into, like, popular, a lot of the popular Tagalog titles. I mentioned it earlier, it's formerly Visprint, now known as 19th Avenida, Ms. Ida Ramirez, Bob Ong, Manix Abrera, Lese, all of these are thanks to her.
Yeah.
So these popular humorous titles that Filipinos are actually interested in. A lot of popular Tagalog or Taglish titles, like that she's now publishing, this she's really creating a new readership and showing that, you know what, Filipinos are interested in their own culture. Right? She's so important to fostering our local comics, our local comics scene as well. Yeah. So definitely we read, but we can obviously do better and in producing more titles that more Filipinos will want to read.
All right.
It's my long one.
It's all right. So we talk about the supply side. What about that was the demand side. What about the supply side in terms of the production of books? Maybe you can talk about how well are we doing in terms of, like, publishing? How much do we publish and what do we publish? And how, maybe you can also relate that to, if there's a match or mismatch with the demand that you described with what we are supplying?
All right. It's not so much a mismatch. It's just that there's a lot that we've yet to unearth that Filipinos would be interested in. I think this is where I can get into, like, the different. So we have about, I want to say, 10,000 ISBN registrations. So the ISBN is an international serialized book number. So every time you publish a book, and if you want mass distribution, if you want to bring it to bookstores, get a barcode for it,
right,
you have to register it with the National Library, who's our ISBN agency here. It gets assigned a number. And then, so that's also how we sort of track book publishing statistics. There's a few caveats there, of course. But in essence, there's about 10,000 ISBN registrations in 2022. Now, that number is not very high compared to our peers, definitely. With their entire companies that dwarf our output by like a factor of 10, just companies, not even countries.
Right.
But so on the supply side, that's why I say we definitely need to publish more. We need to provide more titles for our populace.
Yes.
But there are when people think publishing, they usually just think what's available at what they see at National Books or what they see at Fully Booked.
Yeah.
But really, there's like four different, like, totally different sectors with their own dynamics.
Okay.
Right? I'm sure obviously you're familiar with obviously trade publishing. That's where you have your novels, your short, basically everything you see. That's general consumer.
Yes. Short.
Everything you see in, like, retail. So you walk into a bookstore, stuff that's there. So your Harry Potter, to your Bo Sanchez, to your I don't know, rich dad, poor dad, stuff like that. That's a huge seller. To your like Philippine ghost stories. Those are all like what you call trade
right.
publishing. They have their own little subcategories, obviously, fiction, nonfiction, etc.
Yeah.
But there's also, I mean, this is usually, it's silly that this is something that a lot of people forget could consider when they think about publishing, but obviously the educational publishing is huge. Textbooks and the way educational publishing works is totally different from trade publishing. Rather than looking at working with bookstores to help serve, some of them do, but really the model is like they have salespeople who go to schools, and what they're looking for is classroom adoptions. And you'll find that in most countries, the biggest chunk of the revenue, like of all publishing revenue, is actually in book publishing. It's an educational publishing. So because it's the only time in your life really that you're required to buy, at least hopefully read too, hopefully if you study, hopefully you're reading the textbooks. It's the only time in your life where you have to buy like, you know, six, seven, eight books a year. So imagine 6, 7, 8 books a year. Then let's say you have like, I don't know, 40 students in a classroom, and then how many sections you have per batch, how many year levels there are, so it's K-12, and per school, so easily like the numbers really go up. So you'll have a few publishers whose textbook authors, there's a few textbook authors out there, they're millionaires just off royalties from textbooks, right, from textbook sales. So totally different dynamic. Then obviously you have academic publishing, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Matt.
Oh yeah,
right. Obviously academic, there's journals publishing, and then there's the scholarly monographs.
Yes.
Smaller print runs compared to both trade and educational. Usually it's more reference works. The market's really more for libraries. Interestingly enough, academic publishing, because of the dynamics, because usually it's smaller print run, it's very niche. There's this value towards like indexing and research, you know, and searching and extracting portions of text to cite.
Yeah.
It's actually academic publishing that was the earlier adopter of digital publishing prior to even these ebooks and stuff. You know, so journals publishing, like a lot of it went online way before all this stuff was went to public consciousness. And I know we'll go. We can talk about ebooks. That's another old topic, and we can talk about that later, right? So obviously, with academic publishing, it's a lot more also like credential and citations driven. And showing like your it's really about like providing a scholarly output. That's not something that's like for wide readership, right? Very, very small, very niche. And then there's professionals. We don't have much professional publishing here, but basically it's the sort of thing that you would read to help to keep up with the current practices or current trends in your profession. So you might have your engineering books or new surgery techniques, that sort of thing. Right?
Okay. So like handbooks for different jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So education, trade, academic, professional. Of course, those are more like archetypes really, because they all sort of, sometimes they all blend together. There was a time a big educational publisher actually went into publishing romances. An academic publisher too went into, and I believe that academic is your employer, if I'm not mistaken.
Ooh.
Yeah, for a while, way back in like an early version of DLSU Press, I believe they tried, if I'm not mistaken, to put up a romance imprint.
Really?
I could be misspeaking. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned these four sectors. I don't know. Like, can you say maybe quickly before we move on, like how healthy are they? Are they doing fine, or are there some of these sectors that are doing badly, or what can you say about each?
So I would say we can definitely do better. Let's start with academic, because I think that's something where I think we have to provide a better environment for our academics, for our research.
Yeah, academia.
Definitely. To provide output to like, our journals publishing is very meager compared to other countries. The research support provided is very meager compared to other countries. And that's, I think, when it comes to academic publishing, of course, we have academic publishers that focus on books, but a huge bulk of academic publishing is really in the journals, to be honest.
Right.
So I think that's one thing that's definitely be better. Educational publishing, I mean, these are things that I'm working out with DepEd, the textbook procurement policies. I can go on and on. It's a bit of a long story, but that's something we're actually trying to fix, you know, trying to get a 1:1 textbook to student ratio. Trade publishing, obviously, that has a lot of potential.
Yes.
Already burgeoning, but I think it's just beginning to really bloom and come into its own, which is why Guest of Honors, I believe,
yeah,
in some ways timely, but it's kind of like sort of a catalyst also to accelerate things. But yeah, I think if I could pinpoint any particular one of the four, I mean, professionals, I guess I don't, because I don't, it's very niche and
it doesn't
almost
need to be
non-existent.
large, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be large, but I think academic, or maybe because I'm partial, because I used to work for an academic press, right, a university press. I think there's a lot of room for improvement there.
Although, to be fair, like books that, you know, we've worked on, you know, are currently in like the top 10, at least in fully booked. So they are, maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Like, it can be better, but it has done better compared to previous generations.
So the reason I say academic, as I mentioned earlier, is particularly the journals, right? So our academic output, compared to other countries who have better support, I believe, for their researchers, for their scientists, is very meager. So, which I find very sad. Just I find very, very sad. I mean, I hear a lot of these stories about researchers who were really very precariously financially,
right,
live very financially precarious lives, and it saddens me a lot. I think
okay.
we have to provide better support for that. Our journals, see, that's the thing. Like, when you go to like the journal staff of, or journals or academic publishers of, kind of like, I'm benchmarking again, I worked for Oxford. That's Oxford University Press is like a huge outfit, and
right,
it's an independent, it's has a special relationship with Oxford University that I don't want to get into right now, because
yeah,
they're kind of independent, but they work with the university. It's like a trust. I forget. In any case, Cambridge University Press, those are huge outfits. And then, of course, it's unfair to kind of compare ourselves with the longest and oldest, you know, publishing houses in the world. But
yeah,
still, like, I think there's a lot of room for improvement, also, especially, I guess, with providing distribution for the titles, right?
Okay.
Because these are smaller print run, because these are more niche, he said earlier that these are the things that lend to these fact. These are the factors that usually lend themselves better to digital media, right? We don't have enough publishers who are academic publishers who are making their books available to these what do you call like content aggregators, or like subscriptions available for library subscriptions. I know that because when I was with Ateneo Press, I think we were the first, I'm not believe I if I'm not mistaken, to be on ProQuest. ProQuest launched their ebook library service back then, and then we were, I think, the first and only like Filipino publisher there. And I've been actively encouraging others, and it's really a shame to not get enough content, because this is really, I mean, these are the things that matter to you, because if another researcher, let's say, I don't know, University of Hawaii or Cornell, reads about your work, and then they can cite you, you know, it's easier to cite your book.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why I say, because I see a lot of gaps that need to be filled. Specifically in academic publishing, maybe that's why I'm partial to that. I'm partial
Yeah.
to, like, no, we can definitely do better. Right? There's a lot we can do better.
Yeah,
right?
Wonderful. So you mentioned a lot about, well, I presume that this is predominantly referring to the print publishing of these books. And of course, you mentioned, we touched about it briefly, about, you know, digital publishing and ebooks. Maybe you can tell us, you know, how well the Philippines is doing in terms of digital publishing and how it has affected traditional print publishing, if it has at all done so. So what can you say about that?
So the funny thing is, all right, in one sense, the earlier concerns were, and I always, which I find funny every time, it's like, oh, like, are books dead because of ebooks? Well, first of all, they're still books, right? So second of all, no, even in that case, no, print is very, very much alive. And I'm not saying this because I'm like defensive of like the status quo. I'm like afraid of technological progress. I mean, again, I worked for my first job in publishing was at an ebook company. So I'm very like, but it's because of my exposure there that I also see that I understand the limitations of ebooks. By that, I mean, really, a lot of people still like find print more intuitive. And that's enough of a reason for them to stick with print. And you go back to like, so there's a lot of like media. So let's sort of expand it like a bit to look at other media, like you have film and music, right? And how digitalization, both of those things, digitization is like when you digitize something that's physical and you turn it to a digital file.
Yeah.
Digitalization is like the processes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So look at how digital technologies transformed these industries. And obviously the hardest hit was the music industry, right? Because of piracy. Because music industry was built on album sales traditionally. And then suddenly you have like your Napster and then whatever piracy. And it took a huge hit. And now, I mean, it's a lot better now, but consumer behavior has also changed. Like we're looking at like sites like Spotify, where now people don't think of buying the music. They don't ownership of a particular to own a particular copy of the music or an album isn't as important now compared to what 20 years 20 30 years ago when you had to get the new album would drop and you'd buy the set or the CD or whatever. Now it's like, oh, it's just I'll stream it on Spotify. So if you think of it from access to owner access versus ownership,
right
I think of it as a continuum, right? So which one would you prefer more? You access more titles but you don't really own anything, or you own a few but you access or you own but you only have access to a few,
right?
So that it is completely shifted to favoring more access over owning the actual copy. And this, you see the same thing also with movies, right? So like DVDs are like, I think there's this one clip somewhere on the internet where Matt Damon talks about how there's just movies you can't do anymore because the business, because a lot those quirky like little in quirky little indie whatever movies depended a lot of their revenue on DVD sales, and it's practically non-existent now. So it's all going to be, you just wait for it to be on Netflix, HBO Go, or Disney Plus or whatever.
Right.
So now I bring that back now to ebooks, digital media, right? So how much is access? So this question of access versus ownership. And honestly, it varies depending on if you're, for libraries, obviously they purchase, they want physical copies of certain things, but then for other things, all right, so let's just have a subscription. For a lot of people, it boils down to access. Print books are still, it's very expensive to obviously ship them. So buying an ebook in that sense is more convenient.
Yes.
I will say that the reading experience, so the experience of consuming digital media, again, comparing from Netflix, from film, Netflix, music, Spotify, whatever, and ebooks, the experience of consuming these things in film is in some ways better, like compared to like traditionally. Of course, you still have movie houses, right? And you can still watch music, like very little. I mean, you can have like a very complex setup where you can have very refined, you know, like you have nice speakers, nice headphones, and the experience isn't diminished, like of listening to the music, right? With books, it is like there's a significant hit, I think. That's why, if you look at, if you try to look back to when Amazon was launching the Kindle, and they were emphasizing how it disappeared in your hand, right? And I think that's where you begin to touch on the unique quality of the book, as the book is still a form of technology, right? It's probably like one of the longer it's this form of technology that sort of disappears as if it weren't technology. It disappears into the background of things as nature.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Right? It's part of the backdrop in every Zoom meeting
exactly,
and all that.
Exactly.
Or in your office.
Too,
yeah.
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 Yeah. So, and the experience of consuming. So we go back to what I said earlier about this timid, you know, dialogue with another consciousness.
Yeah.
And really, like, that's what Bezos was trying to say when he's like, it disappears in your hand. No, you will be transported to this world or transported to this other dialogue with this consciousness. You forget about the device. And that's really when you know it works. When you forget about it. The thing with a lot of, because not everyone is reading ebooks, a lot of people read on tablets, on their laptops, and there's just too much noise on their smartphones. There's too much noise.
I mean, there's also audiobooks. Yeah.
Audiobooks
okay.
are also a totally different experience, really expanding the whole notion of what a book is, right? Yeah, and it's also great to provide like accessibility for the visually impaired.
Yes.
Right? So that they now have access to this content. You don't have to translate the Braille or whatever. But in any case, all of these, all of that to say that, has it really impacted? Is it really killing books, or is it really expanding, you know, books to be able to be consumed however people prefer? Right? So this one sociologist by profession, John B. Thompson, he does a lot of work on the Western publishing industry, right? So his latest book is Book Wars. And he shows there's statistics there about there's data there about the share of revenue of print versus ebooks in any particular category. So you'll have your fiction, where it's sort of stabilized by now. So you I'm just throwing out random figures. Let's say it's about like 15-20% will be from ebooks of revenue for a particular title, right? And then the remaining will be like print, and then maybe like a little smidgen will be in audiobooks. And the same thing you see in some nonfiction, in some, I don't know, like business titles. And then you get to romance. Ebook sales are so just spiked almost the majority, if not the majority. Of revenue are in ebooks for romance titles. So it really varies per genre.
Yeah.
For academic, again, so we look at the sectors again. For academic, I think it's majority of the revenue is there. So how much has it affected us? The Philippines are a bit slower to adopt ebooks, mostly because I guess there's a variety of reasons why. But really, a lot of us really just prefer to read in print. And then maybe the devices aren't as accessible and widely available. Yeah.
I mean, Kindles aren't, well,
yeah,
they're a bit expensive for me. But anyway, there's also, I mean, there's also that sensation about like holding it in your hand, lining them up, especially when the colors of, I noticed like the penguin, they design their covers such a way that you line them up and it looks good. It's all black with the titles there.
Yes.
Sometimes it's even mixing and
absolutely.
Matching. Even Ateneo Press, they have great covers when they look great on your bookshelf.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
because
another
it's
thing,
also a social practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, reading isn't just, all right, you consume. Like, we talked about earlier, books are furniture.
Yeah.
There's a whole like social and cultural practice around them.
Yeah.
You know, you use it to decorate. They're in many ways, like just like me in the classroom, rediscovering that books are things. You know, they're not just texts in the academic sense. They are things. They're things that we show at the table to show off how erudite we are, even though we probably haven't read them.
Ah, yeah, they're
right?
Accessories, social status. Yeah.
Yes, it would give us gifts, etc.
Yes, especially with their like a few notes you can write on them, signatures of books, which kind of keeps the book launch community alive, especially when the author themselves wrote a message for you. That's an important thing. Yes. So it won't necessarily die, but I think it's a complicated dynamics there. But it is an interesting conversation to have, especially when, you know, I tried going to Audible, but it's not quite the same, especially when the author is not necessarily a great voice for the audiobook.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So there's a few titles, where it's the author who's reading, and now it's like, oh, what a horrible idea. That's the reason why a lot of these are, I mean, save for a few, like the vast majority, that's the reason they're still alone and they write and not talk to people. Now you try to put them in this, I wish they just got in a voice actor or something, you know?
Sometimes they do, but sometimes the gimmick is there. But definitely from what you've shared, from like the four sectors to like the new digital publishing, you know, there's a lot to be excited about. There's a lot of potential, but you also mentioned there's a lot of room for improvement. So I suppose this is the part of the podcast where you can give maybe a wish list or some prescriptions, like what should be done, maybe by the government or by maybe our society in general, to improve reading and publishing and to address some of the rooms.
This is a trap question. Yeah. It's like everything I say will be, well, why aren't you guys doing it? It's like, oh, we're trying.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. I will say this. I'll talk about my the agency that I work, the National Development Board. Since it was established in 95, it was really, I think, maybe whether it was the main reason, like one of the main reasons for that or not, a lot of things have changed since 95, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that trade publishing in particular has really blossomed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it could, again, always be better. We still have very low per capita, like the number of bookstores per capita. Our country is very rough. I think that's one of the first things that I want to address, not access to books. And this is the thing that my division, we're funding research for that actually for next year. It's in our budget. I mean, it's budget as we record this, it's budget hearing season.
Yeah.
So we propose like for next year, like also not just bookstores, but we're mapping also like just process of like putting up a bookstore, the things you need to know, like you need to get an import license, you work with a freight forwarder, obviously so you get a business permit, so on and so forth, what grants and tax incentives or whatever are available to you. So we're compiling all of those for one. And second, we're also looking at sort of research and mapping the public libraries, right? So we do have a law that requires every LGU to have a municipal library and every barangay to have a barangay reading center. Now, how many have actually put up one? I believe the National Library has a study, and I believe it was only, 5%? Only 5% of LGUs have a public library, which is very, very, very sad. So when we talk about literacy, when we talk on our poor literacy, our learning loss, our learning poverty, we talk about whether Filipinos read. I want you to think about that, really. I want you to think of how many Filipinos can easily access a book, right? How many, and we go back again to our question of access versus ownership, right? So in the same way, like I don't need to buy, do I really have to buy a book to access it? No, that's what libraries should enable, really. So that's the thing that we really want to push for. We're really trying to focus on. So it's not going to be fast. It's not going to happen overnight. Obviously, first we have our first step is really to update the research. So we're funding the research to check, all right, how many now? And to ask further questions, like what are the factors that allow them? You know, was it a good relationship with the LGU? Was the head of the LGU at the time? This and that, and of course we're looking at like some policy changes, maybe including including it as a benchmark or as a factor to get the seal of good local governance, stuff like that. There's a lot of other policy stuff in question that I don't want to bore you with, like the whole Mandanas ruling that's going to take effect in 2024 that provides more budget to LGUs and moving away from the national government and bringing more power and more money, power, and responsibility to the LGUs. stuff like that. So there's, I think, definitely the distribution end is key. Obviously, the logistics is also big, but because we're an archipelagic country, but how do we get, how do we make books more easily accessible to people? That's our big challenge. I think that's something that wasn't emphasized enough in the first couple years of the NBDP, and that's one thing we want to correct.
Okay, so that's, well, more libraries, and I suppose more bookstores, more roads, more ways of shipping these
more
books
roads,
across like archipelago. Yeah, that's a lot of things are involved apparently, and that's very important. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of work to be done on that, and you can get to it. You know, I believe in you. You can do it. I suppose moving from the government, of course, you know, you started your career by being able to promote certain books to a wider consciousness and help contribute that to that reading culture. Maybe you can discuss before we wrap this up. Maybe what should be done by publishers and maybe authors and improving that appetite for reading. You know, like maybe what was your winning formula maybe for promoting the books that you did, and then what can other people do? Yeah.
All right. So I think maybe I was a bit cocky back then because I really just saw like, and this ain't really this is it's really not that hard.
Yeah. Okay.
In the sense that no, it sounds but I guess what I mean by that is a lot of the stuff that publishers aren't doing is very basic actually. Like so write a press release. Write a press release, plan out like social media posts, like content. Now the big thing that's driving discoverability, we call that discoverability in the industry, you know, like how do you find out about a book that you might want to read, right? So that's like the industry term for that is like discoverability.
Right.
And a big driver of that right now is TikTok. As much as people want to say, I mean, some of your listeners might be like, ooh, TikTok.
Yeah.
That's so, ooh. And to be fair, I'm not on TikTok either. But it doesn't change the fact that majority of people are finding out about books, like globally, they're finding out about books through TikTok. I would send out press releases. I'd work with like traditional media, social media. So the reason like a lot of the books that like there's a couple of books that I work on that are still like being reprinted, and I'm really proud of that. We're selling them because there was really an effort to market these books to make people know that hey, these books exist, right? I talked to so many people that were like, well, I don't know, I don't really read a lot of Filipino books, and then like oh. And I talked about like I just mentioned like the ones that I like. I was like, oh, there's a book like that. I didn't know that. Which I was like, I mean, and I'm happy that I got to, you know, educate them about that. But at the same time, I'm sad because see, this is someone who would have been interested if had they known about it. You know, so I really think like our marketing has to be a lot better. Like down to like a few details, like there are books out there. A lot of our publishers still do it, and they know that this is like a pet peeve. Like every time, I always bring it up. Like they don't even write back of the book descriptions, right? Yeah. So maybe there's something that you would have liked. You know, you like already.
Yeah.
Right. Let's say, there's a particular author you're looking for, right? All right. So maybe you're walking into it knowing already. You having heard already. Oh, this so and so has this book, a new book out, right? Maybe a new I don't know, freaking Slavoj Žižek, right? Let's say a new Žižek titles come out, right? And then one of famous political theorist has blurb, right? It's like, oh, this is like the new way of thinking of so and so, a new way of thinking about this particular discipline, and you're intrigued, right? So you grab it. Let's say you grab it, take it off the shelf. You see the blurb, it intrigues you. What's the next thing you do? What is immediately the next thing you do? Flip the book around, find out what it's about, right? There's no excuse even for children's books, by the way, because for children's books, it's the parents who are buying it. And like, I want to know why I should get this for my kid, right? What will they learn? What values will they learn? You know, or will they? What will they learn about, you know, the world or their bodies or their families, etc.? What value? these are things that help drive purchasing decisions, really. Like Nielsen has a whole study about that, where really the most effective way to drive book sales is to just have better information about your book.
Yes.
So that's if there was any particular thing, a specific thing, write better back of the book descriptions, please. Second, now for authors. Honestly, so on the one hand, I wish authors would be more knowledgeable about the industry. Like understand, because they need to defend themselves. We don't, we're a country where there's we don't have many literary agents. It's not that much of a thing here. So there's not that one person who's in charge of like protecting the interests of the author besides the author themselves. And sometimes they get wrapped up in these very sketchy contracts that they don't realize are not in their favor. So on the one hand, it would be pay well to really understand like the business aspect of it. Number one. On the flip side, writers just need to write, man. Like they really, it's hard to balance just really the creative hat and then you try to think of it as a business. There's very few authors I've talked to that are able to do that. So having a little bit of knowledge about how things work, being cooperative with emotions, especially, you know, like showing up, like if your publisher is actually like going out of their way to have events for you and stuff, please, for the love of God, join. And be wary also of like those, what do you call them? Like publishing services outfits. Where you
predatory ones?
Publisher.
Yeah, you have to pay.
Some of them,
yeah.
Yes, for academic ones, yes. For academic ones, yeah. Those are pretty predatory publishers, yes. But in trade publishing, there's also that phenomenon. Now publishing services can be a good thing if you know what you're doing. But if you don't, and then you end up working for a company that's that has questionable business practices, then that's a recipe for disaster. So basically just be cautious about that. If you get into it, please make sure you're working with people who know what they're doing and they're not trying to pull a fast one over your eyes. Right?
All right. Okay. Well, those are very practical tips, and that's a lot to take in, but thank you very much, Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very much,
pull back a bit.
it's definitely an important taste or sample of what's going on in the book industry. And while, quite frankly, the reason why I had this podcast is maybe to ask myself what's going on. Like, you see things like National Bookstore no longer publishing books, or certain bookstores disappearing, certain print magazines. But then listening to you, there's more going on. And so for the listeners out there who think, are books dying? And, you know, after listening to Kevin, no, they're not, but there's a lot to be done. There's still to keep things alive. And I remember certain things there are less magazines, you know, like Reader's Digest or Books About Books. Even certain countries like have review of books, like London Review of Books or San Francisco Review of Books. I'm not sure we have like certain media that reviews books or promotes books the same way. I think we need to work on that. In some
That's
ways,
another thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In some ways, this podcast tries to do that, tries to promote certain books on certain topics, but we can only do so much. But definitely, we do our best and we do our own part in promoting literacy in the Philippines. So thank you very much, Kevin. Now, there's enough for you to talk about it. We'll definitely try to get you back, or maybe you should consider getting your own podcast. There's a lot know you have not discussed, but thank you so much for this. Now let's move on our last segment, which is recommendations, where we recommend additional material that we can read, watch, or check out for more information on the related topic. Let me just say once again before I start recommending that this podcast is produced in partnership with the Manila International Book Fair 2023. It is the largest and longest running book fair in the Philippines. It has been running for 43 years now, with a lot of exhibitions, you know, book signings with national artists, a lot of publishers from mainstream and indie independent publishers to international publishers, and, comic books and best-selling writers. And it'll be held at the SMX Convention on September 14 to 17 from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can follow the link and start register It's free for those who register via the link. Now, Kevin, do you have any additional recommendations for those people interested in, you know, maybe in publishing or in books or maybe in the topic or maybe just something you think the listeners should check out?
All right. So definitely the book from a professor that helped me sort of discover this, like the industry side of things, Patricia May Hurelia's Tagalog Bestsellers of the 20th Century.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's still a couple copies left with Ateneo Press.
Mm-hmm.
So you can check those out at MIBF.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the titles I mentioned earlier, the authors I mentioned earlier, John B. Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff that I said here really was from reading, like the insights I got from reading his book, specifically Merchants of Culture, Book Wars, I think it was Inside Book Publishing. No, that was, sorry, that's another one by, I think that's Giles Clark and Angus Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, like, Priscil Mojares has Origins and Rise of the Filipino Novel. I'm staring at my copy of it right now.
Uh-huh.
So, just to give you a sort of, like, historical context of Philippine publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I can recommend a lot of Filipino books. There's a lot of new books come out. Recently, I just got a copy of Priscil Mojares' new book, Enigmatic Objects, which is a history of the museum in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. I'm in the middle of reading that. It's really fascinating. So and that's something I recommend.
Okay, those are great recommendations. I have actually one book to recommend, but it's definitely related to, well, a large chunk of what we discussed here. And that is, if you're familiar with the book, well, it's his book of the history of Shakespeare and Company, which is a legendary bookstore, the small scale bookstore done by Sylvia Beach. And she is, of course, famous for being among the first publishers who handled, of course, the classics like James Joyce's Ulysses. And she knew personally Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And she would, in this book, she would narrate how hard it was to get money. Just sometimes they would publish Ulysses because it's so long, like chapter by chapter. It would take months. And you notice that from that generation, one of the greatest generation of writers, you know, it wasn't easy to get their books published. So you'd see the daily struggles of that. And you'd see a lot of cameos from like great authors like Hemingway and Fitzgerald.
Great
and
recommendation.
I think you can get a copy somewhere in Amazon, you know, but it's a bit pricey. But if you're into those classics and the behind the scenes of those classics, look into that. And besides, of course, that book, I'll be putting links to, of course, secondhand bookshops that where I get most of my books. You have Wise Guy Bookshop, Page 384, and even this one group of where you can get Filipiniana books that are out of print. So it's a great way to, of course, meet other book traders, which I think that's what a lot, well, it's another discussion there. A lot of secondhand books going around.
Remaindered books. We weren't even able to get to that.
But hopefully, we'll get, we'll have another chance to get you back here. But it's an exciting and definitely substantial episode on books, you know, and we'll definitely try and see if we can get another book episode with the great Kevin D. Yeah, thank you very much, Kevin.
Thanks.
So before we leave, do you have anything to say, maybe anything to promote, maybe where they can find your work or something?
Oh, my work? Oh, no, I haven't. That's the funny thing. I don't write. I don't write myself. I'd rather help like publish. But I guess see you guys at the Manila International Book Fair.
Yay!
Please enjoy. Please, read a lot of Filipino books. Check out all your local publishers there. Support the local industry.
Mm-hmm.
And find a book that you never know. There's the book that was written for you might be on one of those shelves.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing to say. It just hit me. There's this one nice new publisher that I think you've heard of. Like, I've been buying a few of their books lately. Everything is fine. You know, they have this
Oh,
great...
yeah. Katrina Sorsha.
Yes. She's doing, well, much smaller scale printing, but I love their...
That's, yeah.
Yeah.
And
I love their titles.
They've been marketing their books well and promoting it well. So hats off to Katrina and Oliver Ortega.
Yes. I think at least two titles I've checked out myself. There's...
And they have their own bookstore now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's Nothing Deep by Richard Berlisai and Brief Histories by Don... I forgot his last name. Anyway, you got him. Yes. That, him. So, great up-and-coming independent publisher. Check
absolutely.
Out there. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin. I hope to get you back soon. The PI podcast can be found on YouTube, Anchor, and Spotify. If you have any additional suggestions, questions, or messages for us, you may email us at pipodcastph@gmail.com, or you may follow us on Facebook and send us a direct message. But until the next episode, magandang gabi, mga ka-PI.